You know why? Because the Passover comes around every year. We have every year a year, don't we? And so in every year we have the first month and the Passover comes around. It's so simple any child could understand it. So that just because Jesus observed the Festival of Tabernacles once, that didn't do away with observing it. That was Jesus Christ fulfilling the law that he had originally set in motion, giving us an example that we should continue to fulfill it. As it will also be fulfilled, as Mr. Armstrong will explain in the millennium, taking the prophecies in the Old Testament, Zechariah, and so on. But I hope that it becomes a little plainer now that you begin to see that God's will is preserved in here and that we can know it, and that we need to rely on what is here, that this book contains the historical evidence of what the New Testament church observed, that church is called the Church of God, that this church is the Church of God. And an interesting thing, I just brought one of the song books up. It's a song that's sung usually in the world, and we sing it here. It speaks like a mighty army moves, not the Catholic Church, not the Lutheran Church, not the Methodist Church, or any other church for that matter, but it says, moves the Church of God. That's God's own church, the church that Jesus Christ said, I will build. Brothers, we are treading where the saints have trod. We're following in the same footsteps. We are all divided. All, many bodies, we. Not the same in hope, nor the same in doctrine, nor the same in charity. Now that's actually the way the world sings this, in the heart, though they say the words is written properly. Because if all the churches of this world are the churches of God, they don't all have the same hope, they don't all have the same charity or love, they don't all have the same doctrine. Now anyone who sings this is either admitting that this is the church of God, or that there is none. Because there is no unity in the churches of this world. But we find that there is the Church of God in the New Testament, the story of which is continued throughout the times till our day in the first, second, and third chapters of Revelation. I won't explain the history of the churches, but I want to give you a problem. As I said before, and Mr. Meredith mentioned this morning, we're to prove all things. And as I said before, too, that if we are right, which we are, it demands evidence on your part to show that in the past, these very things that we observe today not only were observed by the apostolic church, but that we should also be able to prove that there is a period of transition in which there were some who were rising up and who were stamping out the truth and who were perverting the truth and gradually threw away the truth of God and forced those who were obedient to flee. You are familiar, of course, if you've read the article on when and how often to observe the Lord's Supper and Easter is pagan and the articles that have appeared in the magazines, of the fact that for centuries the festival of Easter, as the world observed it today, was not practiced on this day as the world today follows it. In fact, the celebration of Easter, as it is presently done, was not a universal custom even in the Catholic Church till long after the days of Charlemagne, almost 1,000 years after Jesus Christ rose from the dead. I can prove that, but I'm not going to do it now because that's relative to the Passover. Even after the days of Constantine, the Catholic Church warred within itself. Some saying we must keep the pagan holiday Easter on one day, some saying it on another. And it was not until after the days of Charlemagne, who enforced by the edge of a sword, that there should be only one day for this pagan custom. Who has these facts? The Church of England. Any church who wants to look them up, they're available. The greatest scholars know it. But the greatest scholars assume that just as the Old Testament is unhistorical and represents the tradition of the Jews as they try to develop a concept in God, so they assume that the church today is developing a new concept and a new idea of God, and the old things that were originally revealed were for the primitive church. Take the case of the Jews in the days of Christ. They said, look, Moses said this, but we're getting better and better. We can now understand what Moses gave our ancestors But we believe that we understand them better than any other generation has understood them. And so they developed the customs of the elders. And now the ministers, for the past hundreds of years, even almost 2,000 years, they have said, look, we understand that Paul was a pretty good man. He improved on Peter. He gave us some things that Peter didn't reveal. And we believe that Paul made the first step in the right direction. And so they have begun to add new things and new customs and have advanced on the Apostle Paul. That's the usual concept. You see, human beings want to think themselves wise, in which they become foolish. They don't want to hang on to the truth. They look at the first revelation as most primitive, and they think that they can develop something superior. That's human nature. This church age is no different than it was from the days of Moses to the days of Jesus Christ. Now, if the Jewish Christians observed the Festival of Tabernacles and the Gentile Christians did not, then we should not expect the Gentile Christians to be worrying about keeping the Feast of Tabernacles if they never kept it there in the first place. But we read in Thessalonians, the first chapter, that Paul writes to the Gentiles in Thessalonica. This was in Europe, where the Gentiles certainly predominated, that you, brethren, verse 14 of chapter 2, became imitators of the churches of God. Not the Methodist, not the Episcopalian, the Lutheran, the Catholic, or any other church, but the church of God. All right, so the Gentiles, then we're becoming converted, leaving our old customs now, and becoming imitators of the churches of God, which are in Judea, in Christ Jesus, which even those who are of this modern ideal recognize as Jewish Christians, keeping the customs as we find in the New Testament. And as Mr. Armstrong mentioned this morning, they want to leave out so much of the New Testament because they find that these things which you are observing with all the rest of your brethren today were taken for granted in the writing of the New Testament, and it just woven in all the way through. The dates are measured from this is the Day of Atonement. This is the Day of Pentecost, so this is the Day of Unleavened Bread. Now, the usual argument is that they didn't observe those days, they just put in there. But they're all given there to show that they measured time by those days, and that they were important in pointing out the changes of the seasons. If they observed Christmas and Easter and New Year, Paul would have said, with respect to the 27th chapter, that we began to sail in the Mediterranean just prior to Halloween, or something like that. That's what he would have said. Or in the winter, I hope to abide so-and-so until Christmas is gone. Now, did he say any such thing? Of course not. Now, here we have Gentile converts following the churches of Jesus Christ, called the Church of God in Judea, made up of Jewish brethren, of whom we read in the 20th and the 21st chapters of Acts that they were all very zealous of the law. I won't take time out to read that. You glance over that. I think you won't have any difficulty in noticing the 21st verse of the 21st chapter that the Jews who were in Palestine and converted were all zealous for the law. And they had been told that Paul was teaching things contrary to that. And Paul himself said, of course, that he was not in many a case. But here is the point we're coming to. If we can show that the Gentile Christians, not Jewish Christians, but Gentile Christians, long after the days of the apostles, long after even the last one had been dead, were still troubled about how to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, then we have one step in the link to show that many were saying they should be, the Festival of Tabernacles should not be kept, and others saying that they should. Not in God's church, not in some heresy, not in some little sect, but within the fold of the Catholic Church itself. Not some Jewish sect called the Nazarenes, which observe these days. The Nazarenes, not as we know them in the world, but as they were originally called. That was the name the world gave to the early Christians, after Jesus of Nazareth. But I think it behooves us to have proof. But since some of us too are Gentiles by birth, then it is the custom of all of you rightly to assemble and to keep these things
which God revealed to the Jews, which the Jews themselves did not keep.
While in England, I obtained an unusual book that's entitled The Towers and Temples of Ancient Ireland. Of course, it's on a different subject, but I want to show you the policy of this pagan sect town, as Mr. Armstrong mentioned this morning, that was developing in the New Testament church. There were some who crept in unaware, as there are some here who have crept in unaware. And they seek to pervert the truth of God, as they did at that time. They wanted to say, let's have more people come, or let's see if we can get more people into the church. Let's let the bars down. Let's begin to lay aside some of these Jewish customs. Let's be Gentiles. After all, we live in the world. We've got to get along in the world. And that argument went over. Now, Paul tells us that the mystery of iniquity, of lawlessness, was already working even in his day. And he says, furthermore, that the time was going to come very soon when they would see these things thoroughly developing. And John tells us that the center and the source of all that has polluted the world is Babylon. And even the Catholic Church will admit that Babylon is the city of Rome. That Babylon is the city of Rome. Now, it is a strange thing, as we read in the article, I hope you have read that this past spring, on the fact that the custom of developing, of observing Easter on the general day in which it is now observed by the world standard in the city of Rome. And we have the very name of the first bishop there who developed that idea. And he said, and I want to read one statement from this volume here by a man who was a Catholic named Irenaeus, and he himself said, you read this before, but I want to impress it on your mind, that they not only did not observe the true custom, but they did not permit those who came after them to do so. They observed new customs. They did not permit those who came after them to obey the truth. As we read in Romans 1, they squelched. They held down and suppressed the truth of God by a lie. Furthermore, in order to substantiate the authority of that church alone, they said the Apostle Peter's been here. Yes, he's our founder. And they said, by the way, that Linus is the first bishop. Now, I want to show you something. First of all, you are familiar with what Dr. Meredith wrote in his thesis, that there was a Peter at Rome. And that in their mysteries, they had their stone book, Tetroma. And that the Babylonian word, referring to the grand interpreter, who was Ham, was P-E-T-R. Spoken of in the Roman world as Peter. And so it wasn't hard for these Gentiles who didn't want to follow the Jews and had it in for them, as you can read it in even the book of Romans, that they wanted to follow their customs, and what could be better to take the apostle to the Jews? You remember Peter was the apostle to the circumcision. Taking their apostle, saying that he was the one who came to Rome, he founded our church, we follow the customs of the pagans, Peter supported the very things. He was the founder of this church. He therefore condoned all of the customs that we have. That's why we don't want to obey those things which are written in the Old Testament anymore. But that wasn't enough. They wanted to go one step forward. They wanted to give their church real authority. Now the whole Roman world, the Gentiles, had known of Peter at Rome. And so when thousands of Gentiles crept in the church, they heard the Jews say Peter would never went to Rome. But they said, yes, Peter has been at Rome. We've heard that he's been at Rome for a long time. He's the interpreter of Jesus Christ. Of course, there was this pagan mystery system that centered in Rome at this time, where the high priest was the interpreter, the people of the God of this world. But an interesting thing is that they said the first bishop after Peter, and actually the first man who was the bishop at Rome, they said, was a man by the name of Linus. Now, just as they found the name Peter in the Bible, they also found the name Linus. And we read in the
First letter to Timothy, chapter 4, verse 2, 1 Timothy 4, 2, that Peter speaks of a man by the name of Linus, R-I-N-U-S. Now it so happens that the pagans worship a god by the name of Linus. And one of the names of this god was called Narcissus, which in the early Latin meant the son of Cush. You see, it all stemmed from that original sin in the family of Nimrod and Ishtar and Tammuz. And all of these pagan customs developed through commemorations of the events in the life of that family and all the sins that family brought into the world. Now, the Roman itself, not only has Peter been here, but so has Linus, and he's our first bishop. And all the Gentiles have been singing the song of Linus. You read that in history. Take any book on the antiquities of Greece and Rome in any public library. They find names in the Bible of people who have been at Rome. They find the pagan gods have the same names. They said these people mentioned in the Bible must have been at Rome, and Linus was, but he wasn't any bishop at Rome. He was dead by the time they say he was bishop. But they made those two men the foundation of their church. And they said that those two men approved the customs they were doing, and they used those two means in order to hoodwink the whole Gentile world into assuming that the people they have been following in the Peter and the Linus of the pagans, and Linus is just another term for Nimrod, as the different nations in the world use different names, you know, because they have their set up in languages. They said, look, instead of worshiping those men in the past, we keep the same names, and we'll actually follow the customs that we've always been doing, but we must remember that a new Linus and a new Peter have given sanctity to these old customs that the pagans have had. And on it went. And so the Gentiles have their gods, Dagon, you know, the fish god of the Old Testament, Moloch, the god of the Ammonites and the Moabites, and even Sarpon, that is the destroyer. And so it is interesting that in this book on the towers and temples of ancient Ireland tells us a few of the saints of the Catholic Church. And we read of St. Dagon, St. Moloch, and St. Satan, who are canonized by the Catholic Church. They use all the pagan gods and all the demons, elevated them to the authorities in their church and the saints and prayed to them in order to give sanctity to the heathen customs they wanted to bring in. You ought to look. Now, that isn't all. I've read you the simple ones that are so plain and so simple, any child could see who the saint is. But how are we going to get around the fact that Gentile Christians were observing the Feast of Tabernacles? And that they, Gentiles as a whole, knew that they should. False teachers would have to think of some argument. Now, how are we going to get around it? Well, I have a book here which contains the writings of a man named Methodius, who lived between 260 and 312 A.D. Just before the time of Constantine, over 200 years after the death of the Apostle Paul.
Fundamentally at Rome and has spread around the world today. And this man tells us in one of his writings that for what was the purpose of the theologian Moses in introducing the Feast of Tabernacles in the book of Leviticus? Tell me then, what was the object of the Feast of Tabernacles? Now, we know, I won't explain this because this is a whole sermon, what it symbolizes. Just remember that in Matthew 13, Jesus shows what the picture of the harvest meant. And the Feast of Tabernacles was meant to picture the harvest of souls, the gathering in of human beings into the kingdom of God. But now the Catholic Church had to come up with some excuse for the reason that the Gentiles had been keeping this festival all this time, but they said that we now have a better understanding of what it is. We know a little more than our ancestors. They had to think of some reason to knock in the head the observance of the Feast of Tabernacles. Now remember, I said that the original perversion of all that is in the world came from an abuse of sex in the family. Now, what greater idea could be developed but to show that the Feast of Tabernacles has nothing to do with what God said it did, that it doesn't represent the harvest of souls, that it doesn't refer to all of us being gathered into the kingdom of God, but that it has something to do with sex. And that's what they found just worked out fine. Here's what they said. They read in 2 Corinthians 5 where Peter calls the spiritual body, which will be given to all of us at the resurrection, a tabernacle. 2 Corinthians 5. Now that tabernacle of the future is one that you are going to get, every one of you who are in this audience, I hope. Maybe some of you won't. But there's no reason that you wouldn't, unless you yourselves are responsible. But that's referring to the body that we all shall have. And so this man Methodius came up with a good idea. He said to himself, in all likelihood, at least he wrote it down here, that I can show the people why they shouldn't keep the Feast of Tabernacles now if I can show them that the Feast of Tabernacles has nothing to do with the plan of God as far as the harvest of souls, but if I can show it has something to do with the fleshly tabernacle that we all are. And Paul, in 2 Corinthians 5, speaks of this mortal tabernacle, the tabernacle of this building. And that is, in other words, a tabernacle is just a building. Now, my mind is within the body, and that's what he meant. So here is what they argue, and here is his point, that the Feast of Tabernacles typifies virginity. And you know, that sounds crazy to us. I see Mr. Armstrong has a frown on his face, wondering how any man would ever come up with such an idea. Well, now, really, when I read some of these things, I am utterly astounded how any man could myself. But he said within himself that I believe this is the key. Now, look, we are to keep the Feast of Tabernacles by dwelling in booths. And he shows time and time again here that God commands us to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. He couldn't argue that away. All the Gentile world 200 years after the days of the apostles acknowledged that the Feast of Tabernacles should be observed, but what he wanted to do was show that they weren't observing it right. That's what he wanted to do. He himself said here, "For in the new and indissoluble creation, the one that is to come, whosoever shall not fulfill the commands of the law and shall not keep and shall not have previously celebrated the Feast of Tabernacles will never enter into the land of promise." The whole church still followed the observance of those days up to 200 years afterward, but there were many in the midst who were following the pagan customs already, and they were trying to put over on the people, the teachers putting over on the people, the idea that you shouldn't keep it anymore. And many people would still like to get out of it even in God's church at this very day. And so it isn't very hard to find something that will go over. And they said that in observing the festival of booths and in building a booth so they could have a temporary dwelling, the same as we have our tents as a temporary dwelling here, that they were to cut out the boughs of the tree and the thick branches and to construct a hut, something in which they could dwell for that period of time, so they would remember that they are not in their own home, they are not in their inheritance, but only sojourning. Now, this man said within himself, and here's his reasoning, that wherefore, whoever desires to come to the Feast of Tabernacles, he should first of all produce the goodly fruit of faith, then the palm branches, that is, attentive meditation upon the study of Scriptures, and then use the thick branches, that is, charity, and then he goes on and on to show that all of the things that were to cut out for the trees to build a booth represented the character of a man. And he said that most important, of course, is the character expressed by one of the trees. Now here is where studying the Bible is very important. In the Septuagint translation, which was the Greek translation used in many areas of that world, a translation of the Old Testament into Greek, in the chapter of Leviticus where it tells you what trees to use, the Greek translation added one word, and that word was agnos, agnos, and it was a word that meant a willow tree. And he seized upon that. That isn't in the original Hebrew. It was added in the original Greek. It's just a word that means a willow tree. But the same word also means virginity in the Greek. And here is what he found he could do. He could say, look, God says that you're to build yourself, build a tabernacle with the agnos, or a willow tree. And he said that means that you're to adorn this temple here, this body, with virginity. And he goes on and on with his argument that it is absolutely sinful for a person to marry. And if a person does marry, it's one of the things that God tolerates. In other words, because in this day and age, so many people in their own homes are living in not only in sin but in unhappiness because they don't understand the principles of sex and marriage, He knew that the whole Gentile world had gone off on that, and that they weren't happy in their home, and that most Gentiles felt that virginity was better than being married. And so he seized upon that idea. And he said, I can show that in keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, God meant that we should stay virgins. That's the strangest line of reasoning. And he said, the tabernacle is your body. And when you keep the Feast of Tabernacles, you're supposed to remain a virgin. And he said that you're not supposed to celebrate it in this day, because to be kept in the seventh month, and this world has only the 6,000 years, and he said the seventh one is to come, see? So he wanted to put that off, too. He used every line of reasoning to get around God's law. Now, what's wrong? In the first place, the tabernacle referred to there as a place of dwelling. We have the explanation given in the book of Nehemiah, where we know exactly what was meant by a tabernacle. It was a place in which they could dwell. It was a booth, a tent. It's sometimes translated tent in your Bible. It didn't have anything to do with this body. But that idea went over. The Gentiles didn't want to be morally upright or spiritually upright in their sex life. And those who wanted to be spiritually Christian said to themselves that I'm going to stay a virgin, which most of them did not do. And they began to bring in these pagan customs to commemorate the very sex perversion that started this civilization on its toboggan slide of sin. And they finally got rid of observing the Feast of Tabernacles in the Catholic Church by telling the people that you're not supposed to keep it now, but you're supposed to be practicing doing it by being a virgin now, so that when you were born in the kingdom of God, when there will be neither marriage nor giving in marriage, then you're going to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Now that's how they got around it. They substituted almost every custom for something that is in the Bible, because human nature doesn't want to obey God. Now I think we'll see that not only did the Catholic Church keep it for that length of time, but that we have absolute proof, as we mentioned before, that God's own people have observed it time and time again, even though they were persecuted and were forced to flee. We have the records even of some of the names of human beings in England in the 1600s, in the days of Queen Elizabeth and after, the very first and last names and where they live in their whole life of those who kept these festivals. They're in our own college library in Robert Cox's History of the Sabbath Question. There is absolute proof that the Gentile church, converted to the truth of God in the Bible, observed these days even after the death of the apostles, but many of them, of those who were outside of the church, came within the local fellowship, professed to be teachers of wisdom, perverted the truth of God, and it was not until even after this time that they were finally able to stamp it out. And as I mentioned before in one of the articles, that even after the days of Constantine, the Catholic Chrysostom had to give sermons in his own diocese to prevent his people from observing these festivals with the Jews. And he specifically mentions the Day of Atonement, the Feast of Trumpets, and the Feast of Tabernacles. All three of them in the fall, and we have absolute proof that the others were being observed. Now, if anyone should tell you this is Mr. Armstrong's idea, or you're being taken back to the Old Testament time, all you have to tell him, if you want to point out the Feast of Tabernacles, is that in the Ante-Nicene Fathers, the writings of the early Catholic Church, the so-called Fathers of the Church, is all the evidence that would incriminate them in their sins, would show that they deliberately tried to stamp out the truth of God by unrighteousness and to exchange the truth for a lie. And so the whole Catholic and Protestant world has followed the same customs and have gone so far away that today they do not remember one shred of evidence that in those early days, the Catholic Church was simply torn asunder, and everyone was disagreeing on how to keep these annual festivals, how to keep the Passover and Easter, how to keep the days of unleavened bread instead of Lent, and Pentecost was being observed on several days. They were in total confusion. Now, if the customs of this world were right, and if they came from the apostles, there would never have been that confusion. That confusion could have risen only out of the fact that false teachers came in, many of them teaching different doctrines, and they finally had to organize it by the power of the Roman state from the time of Constantine onward. What more proof could anyone ask?